loosening all the restraints on executive power means that the U.S. is not as reliable a democracy as it used to be.
Welcome to this IBA Global Insight podcast. I'm William Roberts, the IBA's U.S. correspondent. The implications for the rest of the world on issues from tariffs to aid of Donald Trump's second term as U.S. president are already highly significant. While it's difficult to predict the course of the next 4 years, at the very least, Trump 2.0 appears certain to be a turning point in the international role of the United States. Ken Murphy, immediate past chair of the IBA Bar Issues Commission and a former director general of the Law Society of Ireland, discusses what Trump's slogan can tell us about his international approach.
What does it mean, make America great again? Is it more now than a slogan? I'm inclined to think it has to have developed momentum over the last 8 years since we first started it, hearing it being deployed. And it is beginning to show signs of being more of a slightly coherent philosophy now. It's a powerful idea, but it's always unclear as to precisely what it represents, because it's never set down in some sort of published manifesto. People interpret it in various ways, but if the author of it and the sole interpreter of what it should be is in fact Donald J. Trump himself, this is a man who contradicts himself on a regular basis and who is famous for anything, is for his unpredictability, rejoices in his unpredictability. And it goes back to the phrase that was used many times around 2016 in the election campaign in 2016, when the mainstream media used to be said they had a tendency to take Trump literally, but not seriously. When in fact, the contrary, the argument was that the proper way to interpret Trump is to take him seriously, but not literally. And I wonder if that's still true. I suspect it is.
Mary Ellen O'Connell is the Robert and Marion Short Professor of Law and Professor of International Peace Studies at the Kroc Institute, University of Notre Dame in the U.S. She describes what the second Trump presidency means for the rule of law globally.
In the short term, we're going to see a lot of pain. There is so much confusion. The sudden cut of foreign aid, for example, is going to hurt a number of very important programs for healthcare. We're seeing families being disrupted in the United States as part of the migration deportation. It's really very disruptive. It is also, perhaps, and it's my actual hope, that this sudden shock of unilateral actions in clear disregard of international law by President Trump will wake people up. So far, we've seen powerful government leaders coming to Trump and not expressing demands, not making demands that international law be complied with on trade, on migration, on environment, on world health. Instead, they seem to be wanting to make side deals. That's not going to get the world back on the normative plane of legal order that we had constructed after the Second World War and that has stood us in such good stead until at least the end of the Cold War. If this kind of real pain continues, let's hope countries really take the opportunity to come together and demand real international law. They gave President Biden, first term of President Trump, President Obama, President Bush, a great deal of leeway to violate international law, the same international law, but it's being done in such a visible way now. There's no pretending that the United States is not complying with its obligations under the 1951 Refugee Convention on the border with Mexico. We were not complying under the Biden administration, but you could pretend with the rhetoric and some of the attempts at refugee screening and asylum hearings, that pretense is over, and nobody can say that the United States is in compliance or trying to be in compliance or making some credible steps. No, that's over. It's the same with climate. Every state whether the president puts in his notice to leave the climate convention, the Paris Agreement, which is a protocol to the 1992 Framework Convention on Climate Change, all the president can do is put in a one-year notice. Our dues will still be owing. This is true of the World Health Organization and the Paris Agreement. Any funds that we will owe this year. If they're not paid, then it's up to the other members of those organizations to impose countermeasures and make it clear that these basic rules apply to the United States. That's going to take cooperation and commitment to real international law, and for countries not to try to go it alone and make side deals with Trump and somehow be the ones who Trump favors so that they can carry on as usual. We need to stop pretending that this is the international world we want, that this is the system of legal order we want.
Hila Rasul Ayoob, Director for Planetary Politics Initiative at the think tank New America, assesses the implications of the Trump administration's significant cuts to U.S. foreign aid.
The U.S. provision of foreign aid has never been charity. It's never been done out of the goodness of our hearts. The fact of the matter is that U.S. aid and the provision of foreign aid is a tool of foreign policy. And while it's difficult to quantify, there is reciprocal value. It's a value that has been understood by both Republicans and Democrats since President Kennedy created USAID, which is why the agency has had bipartisan support for so long, including from Secretary of State Marco Rubio, who's now in charge with the dismantling of USAID. But what's also interesting is that this has also been something that's been understood by the beneficiaries of this kind of aid, and it's important for people to understand, but the detractors of USAID. And so it's no surprise that the cheering section of the demise of USAID consists of autocrats. Right now, we're seeing the real life ramifications, and we won't fully know the complete impacts of it. But, aside from people losing their jobs and NGOs and organizations shuttering, it has other instantaneous ramifications. There's an Ebola outbreak that's now unattended. There's U.S. made food aid that is wasting in ports around the world. We have oxygen supplies for patients being cut off, clinical trials for new treatments to combat malaria, cholera, and cancer interrupted. I was just reading recently how Ghana is quickly scrambling to kind of close the gaps. And so this all makes you wonder, what will then happen when we go to these countries and ask for something? I don't think there's going to be a whole lot of goodwill here. And so aside from the moral failings, which shouldn't be discounted, you can't tell me that this pullback will not blow up in our faces. Even if Americans don't fully understand the value of foreign aid, people in other countries do. They've always understood it to be transactional. Military bases for aid, access to intelligence for aid, access to markets for aid, all in service of the United States.
Kim Lane Shepley, who is the Lawrence S. Rockefeller Professor of Sociology and International Affairs at Princeton University, outlines what America's current path towards autocracy means for the rest of the world.
Loosening all the restraints on executive power means that the U.S. is not as reliable a democracy as it used to be. Russia and Hungary, this is exactly what happened in those two places. Were there tanks in the streets at the beginning? Was there an announcement, "Hi, I'm a dictator"? No, both Putin and Orban were lawyers, and they chipped away at the democratic foundations of their governments, weak foundations in the case of Russia, much stronger foundations in the case of Hungary. But they brought a dictatorship about because they eliminated checks on power. Okay, so the U.S. is heading down that road. Is America going to be a democracy? What kind of leadership will the, because the U.S. is going to insist on leadership, but it may not be the kind of leadership you would expect from a constitutional democracy that has honored human rights and its international commitments. We're going to be going down the road of a very different kind of government. And so the question is what role that government is going to play in international institutions. I think certainly you see the Trump administration wants to torpedo and target a number of institutions that he feels get in the way of his agenda. But he's also going to be building partnerships with a lot of governments that you probably have not associated the U.S. government with. We know from his first administration that Trump loves dictators. So is that going to be the new set of alliances that the U.S. now has? What happens to a group like NATO, which has thought of itself as a union of democracies protecting what we used to call the free world? You know, what's going to happen, that, given that it's not just Hungary, I mean, not just the U.S., but it will be Hungary, it's Turkey. The Netherlands has a far-right party in government. It's a lot of NATO countries that are moving in this direction. So, you know, is the U.S. going to be the partner that stands up and says, hey, wait a second, there's a reason to preserve alliances of democracies? Or are these alliances going to start promoting other forms of government that are not the clear democracies that we used to have? So, you know, the reason why I sound so pessimistic is not to just, you know, get everyone freaked out, but to say I worked in Russia and in Hungary when these countries were moving in a democratic direction, and I watched them go the other direction. And I know, having been a lifelong citizen of the U.S. and taught U.S. law school for many years, that the checks and balances on the U.S. system are not as strong as they look. And what this first wave of executive orders tells us is that Trump is working with lawyers this time, and they are targeting all the places that still provide checks on executive power with the intention of destroying them. So I think we all ought to be shouting at the top of our lungs that this is what's happening here. And I hope the rest of the world can help us